Chapter 40. July AD 2067. Year 11, ERC, Winter. Tash was late for Mel's funeral, and that was despite the small government-issue car having made an efficient job of driving her from Government House in Gateshead all the way to the opposite corner of England and this small, ancient church outside Salisbury, close to Mel's childhood home. Of course, traffic was never heavy nowadays, although the car had projected a blue police icon to clear the way a couple of times. Even so, by the time the car rolled to a halt outside the walled cemetery, it was getting dark, this brief winter day ending. A July day by the old calendar, another day deep in the heart of another winter that still felt anomalously long. A decade after the Blink's huge wrecking of the seasons of Earth. As soon as the car released its locks, Tash was out, pulling her heavy black coat around her. And here was her father, leaning on a stick, waiting for her, outside an ancient wrought iron gate. She held still for the usual perfunctory kiss on the cheek. Then he led her through the gate and up a short path of cracked paving stones to the dark pile of the church. "Got a cab," he said, wheezing heavily. "You nearly bloody missed it altogether." The wheeze was a relic of one of the respiratory conditions that had run around the country a couple of years ago. A disease actually related to Mel's own final illness. Noel was only 73, she reminded herself. He might have been a decade older. And Tash, only 40 herself, felt the weight of her years too. She linked her arm with his, and they hurried up the path as best they could. "Well, I'm here now. That's what being an advisor to the Prime Minister gets you. On the one hand, overrunning meetings, on the other hand, priority ministerial-grade transport. On the third hand, not that high a priority. No more chopper rides, for instance." Sometimes she actually missed Grace Butterworth. Grace had known the system far better than Tash ever would. She would have found a quicker way to get here. But Grace was in a high-security military prison, location unknown, and was never likely to emerge. They paused in the stone porch, with notices about baptisms, funerals, service times, and pub quizzes. A heavy wooden door opened into the church. Noel breathed hard, and Tash pushed back her hood, shaking out her hair. "Well," said Noel, folding back his collar, "I would say poor Mel was honoured to have you come all this way. But you're not the only VIP here, you'll see. There are people packing up to leave already, too bloody cold. But I suppose you lot know all about that." Tash kept her counsel, knowing what he was fishing for. News of the ice packs forming around Iceland and Greenland, for instance. Fears that the Gulf Stream might be closing down. In one of her final conversations with Tash, Mel had tried to explain all this to her. There was a gathering fear among the climatologists that, under all the weather chaos post-Naples, in the longer term, the cooler post-Blink northern summers were precursors to a slide into a new ice age. This, apparently, was how it had begun in previous glaciations, with patches of ice lingering through the northern spring and summer, reflecting back a little more of the sun's heat year by year. But the subtle changes in Earth's rotation and orbit, the precession and tilt of the spin axis, and the eccentricity of the orbit, were all messed up now, making predictions harder. "That's the fear," Mel had admitted. "Nobody knows. But we're not there yet." That was Mel, always trying to end on a positive note. Tash felt a sharp, deep stab of grief, of loss. Noel studied her. "You okay?" She found she had to blink back tears. "No. But whatever the state of the world, we're here today, together," she said quietly, squeezing his arm tighter. "And that's all that matters." He patted her hand on his arm. "That's my Tash. Late or not, come on." They opened the door, walked up the aisle. The church was a squat, cold stone pile, with a gloomy light admitted through grimy stained glass windows. It was not unlike St. Joseph's in Gateshead, Tash thought, where she still called in every now and then, mostly remembering Blink Day when she did so. And like St. Joseph's, the church looked 19th century, Tash thought, an expansive age that had bequeathed an awful lot of the country's surviving monumental heritage, as she had seen for herself, especially in the last few months she had spent accompanying the new Prime Minister Fred Bowles on tours of the nation, and too many funerals. But still, it was cold, gloomy, unwelcoming. The handful of people here were mostly congregated in the pews towards the front, but a few were scattered at the back, locals perhaps, or old friends from Mel's childhood, shy of the family and adult acquaintances. One man Tash didn't recognise, older, sat entirely alone at the back. There were no clergy here, no organ playing, and no coffin. Tash was getting used to such sights as part of Prime Minister Bowles's entourage. Since the blink 10 years ago, even in comparatively secure and stable Britain, the death rate had steadily climbed, and funerals had changed. Now most hospitals had crematoria. No more shipping possibly infectious corpses around the country. No more graves. No more gravestones. Church services centred on urns of ashes, or no physical token at all. Tash did know there was to be a small ceramic plaque fixed to a new memorial wall outside. A wall slowly building its way across the old churchyard. A post-blink custom. A plaque for Mel. They kept walking forward, slowly. And Jane was here, Tash saw now. Unmistakable. She was standing in the centre aisle, tall, her vivid red hair cut neatly short, but not shaved, as it had once been. Mel's daughter stood with friends before the altar, cradling her own baby. Another Melissa, Tash knew, just a few months old. Now she turned, evidently recognised Tash and nodded, but her smile was cautious. Tash had always had the sense that as Jane had grown up, she was 21 now, she had come to disapprove of her mother's old friends. Maybe every child somehow resented a parental past they could never share. At that thought, she squeezed her own father's arm. And now, as she pressed deeper into the gloom of the church, Tash saw who her father had meant by other VIPs. Sitting in a pew, Charlie Marlowe twisted around to see Tash and Noel approach. Charlie, still the Astronomer Royal, was pretty unmistakable, even from behind. A broad back swathed in a brilliantly coloured jacket. No morning black for her. And that startlingly bright scalp of crew-cut, silver-dyed hair. "About bloody time," she murmured. "And don't give us that stuff about working for the Prime Minister." "She already has," Noel said. "Because so do I, and I was here on time. Mind you, Jane's father has been and gone. Ever meet him? I don't think they were ever close. Even your friend Xi, stuck out in the Kuiper Belt, managed to send a message to get here at the right time." Tash gave in with a nod, but she said, "Actually, he's already on his way home." Since the Moonlurker had been destroyed, and Pioneer 14, out in the Kuiper Belt, had been recognised as the only conduit through which humanity had any chance to feed information to Galaxius, as well as the best place to study its engineering, the Pioneer had been turned into the core of a permanent installation, with fresh crew and facilities on the way out from Earth, and Xi was to be the first to be brought home. And thinking of him suddenly made the loss of Mel real, vivid for Tash. After all, she hadn't even been able to speak to Xi since the news of Mel's death, in a critical care ward in a Chilean hospital. Mel had been working with Marlowe at the high-altitude Andean observatories and had been caught by a local epidemic. Thinking of Mel, Xi, she found tears welling in her eyes. Oh dear. Oh, love. Her father limped over and cautiously folded his daughter in an embrace. Marlowe looked away. Now Jane emerged from her small knot of mourners and approached. Her baby was in her arms, wrapped in a soft white blanket. "Tash, thanks for coming." "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be such a mess." "It's okay," said Jane, kindly enough, showing her baby. Her face was expressionless. "Take all the time you need, but oh, excuse me. There's somebody I need to speak to at the back." She passed and walked on down the central aisle carrying the baby. She knew that after her post-Blink adventures at trouble spots like Naples, Jane had become a medical student, looking to become a teacher specialising in public health. She'd already planned a doctorate, partly under Charlie Marlowe, on the effects of the new lunar cycles on human psychology, a very post-Blink career choice, and quite different from her mother's physical sciences path. She'd grown up in a different time, a different epoch, Tash thought. Just as smart and wise as her mother, but more focused on people on the short term, especially now she had the baby. Tash had a sudden, vivid memory of how Jane had been only a few years back, the bright, cheeky teenager at in-joke Christmases. "Suddenly I'm nearly blubbing like a kid. I'm 40 years old, for God's sake." "Well, I rather think that's the point, love," her father said gently, sitting down stiffly on a pew. "It is a funeral, you know. You lot, you in-jokes. I was always so glad you had such close friends, Tash. Supportive friends. It's what you need in life. But I always knew as well as that, eventually, well, you would have to leave some of that behind you." Tash, getting back some composure, looked to the back of the church where Jane was talking to that solitary man. "One of us would die, you mean? I guess you're right, Dad, about growing up. I know it's really stupid, but I remember when Jane came along, well, it all changed, even then. Don't beat yourself up. I saw you with her often enough. Mel hardly saw her brother, remember, so Jane had no wider family to speak of. I think at its best you and she were honorary aunt and uncle to little Jane when she came along. But it's complicated," Tash said. "It's always complicated," Noel said sternly. "That's one thing this old fart can promise you about life." "That's right," Marlowe said, standing heavily, one hand on the back of a pew for support. "You get used to it. Noel, let me come sit with you, us old folk together." Jane returned, baby asleep in her arms. Marlowe, taking her seat beside Noel, glanced to the back of the church. "Jane, who was that, by the way, at the back there? Not that it's any of my business, but I did get to know many of Mel's friends." "He's my uncle," Jane shrugged. "Uncle Paul, my mother's brother. I barely know him." "Good of him to come, I guess," Tash said cautiously. Jane shrugged. "He did me no harm. He was pleased to see the baby today. Don't imagine I will see him again. My mother hardly ever spoke of him, or my father." Tash found she didn't even remember the father's name. For Mel, it had been an awkward relationship with a man neither Tash nor Ji had ever met. A short affair in her postdoc years, an accidental pregnancy, an impulsive decision by Mel to keep the baby. Jane said, "I ought to write all this down for the future. Little Melissa will want to know about it someday. I would." Marlowe said now, "Actually, that's my own new project, in a sense. Sorry to overhear. Writing stuff down for the future. Or one of my projects, as mandated by the great Fred Bowles. Such a relief to have a PM at least acquainted with science. Don't you think, Tash? And in the Blink aftermath, as they used to say, he is having a good war. Deserved the top job when Kane was finally toppled." Tash prompted, "Charlie, your new project?" "Yes, sorry, rambling. Anyhow, the project, they're calling it Legacy, is all about memory, humanity's memory. Our memory of the Blink and its aftermath and what we're doing about it." Tash had heard of this, but she hid a smile at Marlowe's bright intervention. She did have a way of coming up with conversational nuggets like this, somehow appropriate to the occasion, inclusive and yet uplifting, as well as interesting. "After all," Marlowe said, "as even government ministers have worked out by now, the Chinese Acorn Project is a long-term development. We need to show our commitment to it, long-term, because that's the whole point, to prove to Galaxius that we are not and never will be a threat. But it's very long-term. Most people haven't remotely grasped that yet. So, at the very minimum, we have to find ways to remember what the hell we're doing." Jane frowned, jiggling her baby. "I thought it was a massive project already." All those Chinese machines digging up mercury? Marlowe said. But this is just the start of a longer-term process. It will take 1,000 years, at least, just to establish the complete belt of particle accelerators around the sun, before we even start to move the bloody thing. Of course, that might change. My bet is that we will come up with something smarter than this first strategy, or the smart replicator cloud will figure it out for itself. Still, for now, that 1,000 years of basic manufacture is our first conceptual horizon. And it's a long time in human terms. 1,000 years ago, the Normans were conquering Saxon England. Our institutions, nations, religions can last that long, but they don't always manage it. But beyond that, our first meaningful stellar encounter will be with Barnard's star, where we will make a closest approach of about 2 light-years in about 10,000 years, which is longer than any human civilization has lasted to date. Maybe, after a fresh renaissance or two, our descendants will have to rediscover what we did and why. And if it takes 100 million years to get out of the galaxy, as some estimates suggest, you are looking at time periods longer than mammals have been around. So what we are wrestling with now is ways of making sure we remember on such timescales, or trying to. Jane frowned. I'd never thought of that. It seems impossible. Intuitively. And yet, we have to do it, clearly. Tash recognised her constructive curiosity, so like Mel's sharp intelligence. I mean, even little Mel here won't remember the pre-blink world, so write it all down. On what, though? Marlowe asked. Our digital records are notoriously evanescent. We could create tremendous stores of records on more or less indestructible parchments, say, kept in more or less indestructible vaults. But even if that survives, could your remote descendants read it? Languages evolve on a timescale of a few centuries. Even the meanings of images change. In 500 years, what do you think a map of the London Underground would seem to signify? And after a few 1,000 years, all this, all we have lived through, might be sinking into myth and legend, falling out of history and into the domain of archaeology, even at best. She glanced around at the fittings of the church. Or religion. Do you remember how the blink was compared to biblical phenomena, like Joshua's miracle day when the sun stood still, which actually was, maybe, some remote, distorted memory of a solar eclipse? And as for the Acorn Project, maybe some new space-going civilization, not understanding the purpose of this big cloud of clunky old factories around the sun, might go out and start mining it for materials. Like Hadrian's Wall, Tash murmured, north of England, where I work. That was robbed for building stone from as soon as the legionaries withdrew. Jane frowned. So we have to create memorials, markers of some enduring material like the Roman concrete I saw in Naples. That has lasted millennia, with engravings of what? Marlowe said gently. We need to describe the sun's journey and its meaning, and establish at least a basic timescale. Images might be the best way. So, for example, you could show how the constellations should have shifted after 10 or 20 or 100,000 years. Continental drift on Earth is quite predictable, so you could use maps of the changing Earth as markers spanning millions of years. You could even use the Andromeda galaxy as a clock. That rotates in a timescale of multiple millions of years. The passing of time in science diagrams. Noel pursed his lips. If I were a god emperor of the year 5000 AD, I might want a monument like that to be brought to my palace, or even smashed up to build my palace. Good point, Marlowe said. So maybe you make it cheap and nasty, Tash said. You use plastic. I know a little about this idea. I remember Mel was working on this before she died. So she was, Marlowe said respectfully. That never goes away, until it's subducted beneath the drifting continents. Create millions, billions of little tokens, each one inscribed with some kind of message. Layered, so if you were smart enough, you could dig out meaning after meaning. Jane smiled. Turning the world's junk into race memory? I like that. Tash nodded. I remember you gave me a Christmas gift once. A sculpted plastic bottle. Jane laughed. I remember that. How embarrassing. She rocked her baby again. Well, we like Grandma's idea, don't we? And little Mel gurgled and laughed. Calm down, you. I think she's getting tired. Me too, Noel said, shifting stiffly. I feel like my rear was cold welded to this pew. Oh, Dad, Tash murmured, but she went over and helped him up. Jane hesitated. Thank you for coming. I mean it. You were good friends to Mum, and I do remember the good times we had. Family stuff, the Christmases, as you say. She would have appreciated this. Look, I splashed out and hired a suite in a hotel in town. I'll ping your phones. Join us later, for a few hours anyhow. Drink some decent tea, whatever you like. In the warm. That sounds a good idea to me. The Astronomer Royal stood grandly. Come, Noel, let's go and get warm. She linked Noel's arm in hers, and she swept down the church, like, Tash thought, a ship setting sail. But they were met in the aisle by the man from the back of the church, the brother, the uncle. He stood now, blocking their way, tall, a pinched face, and wearing a heavy overcoat. Tash thought she could just make out a remnant tinge of red in his rather long white hair. And he had the dog collar of a priest or vicar at his neck. For a moment they stood, slightly wary of this silent man. Tash became aware that he was staring at Charlie Marlowe. This is my Uncle Paul, Jane said stiffly, evidently uneasy herself. Paul, this is... He bowed his head. Astronomer Royal, I have followed your words. He lifted the collar of his coat to reveal a gaudy button badge. Puny Yahweh. Tash tensed. Not for the first time she wished she had Grace Butterworth at her side. The old pre-fanatic, pre-tragedy Grace. But Charlie stayed calm and smiled. Paul? Well, I see we have differing points of view. How? Healthy. Why don't we sit and talk? Come, I think the pews are a little warmer towards the front of the church. She linked his arm, he towered over her, and they walked back through the church. So they were left alone, Tash, Jane, and baby Mel. Jane exchanged a glance with Tash. Phew, she said. And Tash smiled. You sounded just like your mother just then. Before you go, come see her marker stone outside. Just us. Tash nodded. That would be an honour. As they spoke, the baby looked at them wide-eyed, from one face to another. And when Tash stroked her cheek with a fingertip, she laughed with curious joy.